the instinct of self-preservation, should warn us that we ought not to let that happen anymore. And it was because of what effect upon us that I recommended to the Congress in our neutrality law the essentials for American peace. American peace in this war-torn world have not changed since last January or last July. And that is why I ask you again to re-examine our own legislation. Go back a little. Beginning with the foundation of our constitutional government in the year 1789, the American policy in respect to belligerent nations, with one notable exception, was based on international law. Be it remembered that what we call international law has always had as its primary objectives the avoidance of causes of war and the prevention of the extension of war. The single exception to which I refer was the policy adopted by this nation during the Napoleonic Wars, when, seeking to avoid involvement, we acted for some years under the so-called Embargo and Non-Intercourse Acts. That policy turned out to be a disastrous failure. First, because it brought our own nation close to ruin, and second, because it was the major cause of bringing us into active participation in European wars in our own War of 1812. And it is merely reciting history to recall to you that one of the results of the policy of embargo and non-intercourse was the burning in 1814 a part of this capital in which we are assembled today. Our next deviation by statute from the sound principles of neutrality and peace through international law did not come for 130 years. It was the so-called Neutrality Act of 1935, only 4 years ago, an act continued in force by the joint resolution of May 1st, 1937. Despite grave doubts expressed as to its wisdom by many senators and representatives and by officials charged with the conduct of our foreign relations, including myself, I regret that the Congress passed that act. I regret equally that I signed that act. On July 14th of this year, I asked the Congress in the cause of peace and in the interest of real American neutrality and security to take action to change that act. I now ask again that such action be taken in respect to that part of the Act which is wholly inconsistent with ancient precepts of the laws of nations, the embargo provisions. I ask it because they are, in my opinion, most vitally dangerous to American neutrality, American security, and above all, American peace. These embargo provisions, as they exist today, prevent the sale to a belligerent by an American factory, the sale of any completed implements of war. But they allow the sale of many types of uncompleted implements of war, as well as all kinds of general material and supplies. They furthermore allow such products of industry and agriculture to be taken in American flag ships to belligerent nations. There in itself, under the present law, lies definite danger to our neutrality and our peace. From a purely material point of view, what is the advantage to us in sending all manner of articles across the ocean for final processing? Final processing there, when we could give employment to thousands by doing it here. Incidentally, and again, from the material point of view, by such employment here, we automatically aid in building up our own national defense. And if abnormal profits appear in our midst, even in time of peace, as a result of such an increase of our industries, I feel certain that the subject will be adequately dealt with at the coming regular session of the Congress. Let me set forth the present paradox of the existing legislation in its simplest terms. If prior to 1935, a general war had broken out in Europe, the United States would have sold to and bought from belligerent nations such goods and products of all kinds as the belligerent nations with their existing facilities and geographical situations were able to buy from us or sell to us. This would have been the normal practice under the age-old doctrines of international law. Our prior position accepted the facts of geography, the facts of conditions of land power and sea power and air power alike as they existed in all parts of the world. If a war had broken out in Europe in 1935, there would have been no difference, for example, between our exports of sheets of aluminum and airplane wings. Today, there is an artificial legal difference. Before 1935, there would have been no difference between the export of cotton and the export of gun cotton. Today, there is. Before 1935, there would have been no difference between the shipment of brass tubing in pipe form and brass tubing in shell form. Today, there is. Before 1935, there would have been no difference between the export of a motor truck and an armored motor truck. Today, there is. Let us be factual. Let us recognize that a belligerent nation often needs wheat and lard and cotton for the survival of its population just as much as it needs anti-aircraft guns and anti-submarine depth charges. Let those who seek to retain the present embargo position be wholly consistent. Let them seek new legislation to cut off cotton and copper and meat and wheat and 1,000 other articles from all of the nations at war. Yes, I seek a greater consistency. A greater consistency through the repeal of the embargo provisions and a return to international law. I seek reenactment of the historic and traditional American policy, which, except for the disastrous interlude of the embargo and non-intercourse laws more than a century and a quarter ago, has served us well from the very beginning of our constitutional existence. It has been erroneously said that return to that policy might bring us nearer war. I give to you my deep and unalterable conviction, based on years of experience as a worker in the field of international peace, that by the repeal of the embargo, the United States will more probably remain at peace than if the law remains as it stands today. I say this because with the repeal of the embargo, this government clearly and definitely will insist that American citizens and American ships keep away from the immediate perils of the actual zones of conflict. And so, I think that repeal of the embargo and a return to international law are the crux of the issue that faces us. The enactment of the embargo provisions did more than merely reverse our traditional policy. It had the effect of putting land powers on the same footing as naval powers, so far as seaborne commerce was concerned. A land power which threatened war could thus feel assured in advance, that any prospective sea power antagonist would be weakened through denial of its ancient right to buy anything anywhere. This, 4 years ago, began to give a definite advantage to one belligerent as against another, not through his own strength or geographical position, but through an affirmative act on the part of the United States. Removal of the embargo is merely reverting to the sounder international practice and pursuing in time of war, as in time of peace, our ordinary trade policy. This will be liked by some and disliked by others, depending on the view they take of the present war. But that is not the issue. The step I recommend is to put this country back on a solid footing of real and traditional neutrality. When and if, I don't like even to mention the word if, I'd rather say when the repeal of the embargo is accomplished, certain other phases of policy reinforcing American safety should be considered. And while nearly all of us are in agreement on their objective, the only question relates to method. I believe that American merchant vessels should as far as possible be restricted from entering war zones. But war zones may change so swiftly and so frequently in the days to come that it is impossible to fix them permanently by act of Congress. Specific legislation may prevent adjustment to constant and quick change. And it seems therefore more practical to delimit the actual geography of these war zones through action of the State Department and administrative agencies. The objective of restricting American ships from entering such zones may be attained by prohibiting such entry by the Congress, or the result can be substantially achieved by executive proclamation that all such voyages are solely at the risk of the American owners themselves. The second objective is to prevent American citizens from traveling on belligerent vessels or traveling in danger areas. This can be accomplished also either by legislation, through continuance in force of certain provisions of existing law, or by proclamation making it clear to all Americans that any such travel is at their own risk. The third objective, requiring the foreign buyer to take transfer of title in this country to commodities purchased by belligerents, is also a result that can be attained by legislation or substantially achieved through due notice by proclamation. The fourth objective is the preventing of war credits to belligerents. This can be accomplished by maintaining in force existing provisions of law or by proclamation making it clear that if credits are granted by American citizens to belligerents, our government will take no steps in the future to relieve them of risk or loss. The result of these last two objectives will be to require all purchases to be made in cash and cargoes to be carried in the purchaser's own ships at the purchaser's own risk. Two other objectives have been amply attained by existing law, namely regulating collection of funds in this country for belligerents and the maintenance of a licensed system covering import and export of arms, ammunition, and implements of war. Under present enactments, such arms cannot be carried to belligerent countries on American vessels, and this provision should not be disturbed. The Congress, of course, should make its own choice of the method by which these safeguards are to be attained. So long as the method chosen will meet the needs of new and changing day-to-day situations and dangers. To those who say that this program would involve a step toward war on our part, I reply that it offers far greater safeguards than we now possess or have ever possessed to protect American lives and property from danger. It is a positive program for giving safety. This means less likelihood of incidents and controversies which tend to draw us into conflict, as they unhappily did before the last World War. There lies the road to peace. The position of the executive branch of the government is that the age-old and time-honored doctrine of international law, coupled with these positive safeguards, is better calculated than any other means to keep us out of war. In respect to our own defense, you are aware that I have issued a proclamation setting forth a national emergency in connection with the observance, safeguarding, and enforcement of neutrality and the strengthening of the national defense within the limits of peacetime authorization. This was done solely to make wholly constitutional and legal certain obviously necessary measures. I have authorized increases in the personnel of the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard, increases which will bring all four of them to a total still below peacetime strength as authorized by the Congress. I have authorized the State Department to use for the repatriation of Americans caught in the war zone the sum of $500,000 already authorized by the Congress. I have authorized the addition of 150 persons to the Department of Justice to be used in the protection of the United States against subversive foreign activities within our border. At this time, I ask for no further authority from the Congress. At this time, I see no need for further executive action under the proclamation of limited national emergency. Therefore, I see no impelling reason for the consideration of other legislation at this extraordinary session of the Congress. It is, of course, possible that in the months to come, unforeseen needs for further legislation may develop, but they are not imperative today. These perilous days demand cooperation between us without a trace of partisanship. Our acts must be guided by one single hard-headed thought: keeping America out of this war. In that spirit, I am asking the leaders of the two major parties in the Senate and the House of Representatives to remain in Washington between the close of this extraordinary session and the beginning of the regular session on January 3rd, 1940. They have assured me that they will do so, and I expect to consult with them at frequent intervals on the course of events in foreign affairs and on the need for future action in this field, whether it be executive or legislative action. And further, in the event of any future danger to the security of the United States, or in the event of need for any new legislation of importance, I will immediately reconvene the Congress in another extraordinary session. I should like to be able to offer the hope that the shadow over the world might swiftly pass. I cannot. The facts compel my stating with candor that darker periods may lie ahead. The disaster is not of our making. No act of ours engendered the forces which assault the foundations of civilization. And yet, we find ourselves affected to the core. Our currents of commerce are changing. Our minds are filled with new problems. Our position in world affairs has already been altered. In such circumstances, our policy must be to appreciate in the deepest sense the true American interest. Rightly considered, this interest is not selfish. Destiny first made us, with our sister nations on this hemisphere, joint heirs of European culture. Fate seems now to compel us to assume the task of helping to maintain in the Western world a citadel wherein that civilization may be kept alive. The peace, the integrity, and the safety of the Americans, these must be kept firm and serene. In a period when it is sometimes said that free discussion is no longer compatible with national safety, may you, by your deeds, show the world that we of the United States are one people, of one mind, one spirit, one clear resolution, walking before God in the light of the living.
And thus the President of the United States concludes his address, reviewing the neutrality laws of the country before a joint meeting of the newly convened special session of Congress in the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. In just a few minutes, the joint session of the Congress will be adjourned, and the respective houses are expected to convene again on Monday. The applause for the President continues as he slowly turns from the Speaker's platform to go out of the door and out of the Capitol building. We expect to be back here at the Capitol shortly for some important news. This is John Charles Daly speaking from the House of Representatives in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. We return you now to our New York studios.
While the President of the United States was addressing both houses of Congress, Premier Daladier began a message to the people of France. Later, our translator, who has been listening to the speech over shortwave radio, will give you a free resume of the entire message. In the meantime, we will listen to Premier Daladier's concluding remarks. We take you now to Paris.
Bretagne ou en Alsace, elle ne renouvelle pas ses méthodes. Elle cherche partout des cinq ou quatre pour trahir leur patrie. Elle espère trouver des achats pour en scier la déchéance et en consacrer la servitude. Mais la France tout entière s'est dressée. Il n'y a pas chez nous de traîtres, mais un peuple unanime, courageux, résolu, qui inscrit sur ses drapeaux la liberté ou la mort. Après tant de mensonges et tant de reniements, la propagande allemande n'a plus maintenant qu'un dernier espoir. Celui de dissocier les forces qui vont briser sa marche vers la domination du monde. Il est clair que la propagande allemande n'a plus maintenant que deux objets. Elle veut séparer la France de l'Angleterre. Elle veut désunir les Français entre eux. Mais quand les Français entendent les ondes ennemies leur dire que cette guerre est la guerre de l'Angleterre, ils répondent non. C'est la guerre d'Hitler. Comment faire croire à des Français qui, depuis des mois, sentent grandir le péril sur leurs propres frontières qu'ils font la guerre pour la Grande-Bretagne? La propagande allemande a tort de ne pas changer de procédé quand elle déborde le territoire du Reich. Les Français connaissent par l'expérience, autant que par le sentiment, la valeur de l'amitié britannique. Ils voient la marine de l'Angleterre chasser et détruire les sous-marins allemands, ses avions combattre dans notre ciel, ses fils, non plus volontaires, mais soldats par devoir, rejoindre les soldats de France aux frontières de notre patrie. Ils savent aussi qu'un même idéal de liberté et de dignité humaine fait battre le cœur de la France, de l'Angleterre et des centaines de millions d'hommes qui, dans leurs empires immenses, dévouent toute leur force à la cause commune. La radio hitlérienne peut reprendre ce thème à l'infini. Pas un Français ne peut en être dupe. Plus ridicule encore est l'espoir de dresser des Français contre leur patrie. Monsieur Goebbels ou son successeur, de faire entendre à sa radio des voix de femmes qui prétendent parler au nom des mères françaises. Des employés de sa propagande peuvent lire leur appel qui n'est qu'une offense à la douleur des mères véritables. Un Français déshonoré, traître à son pays, peut s'apitoyer dans les studios allemands sur le destin de nos soldats. Aucun d'entre vous ne peut être pris à des pièges aussi grossiers. Ce chantage aux sentiments les plus nobles ne fait que soulever votre dégoût et que raffermir votre volonté. Car la propagande allemande a pu mentir sur tout. Mais il est une chose sur laquelle elle ne saurait vous tromper, vous abuser, c'est votre amour pour la France. L'amour de la France a renouvelé le miracle qui assura notre salut chaque fois que nous avons été en péril. Dans l'épreuve, notre communauté nationale devient de jour en jour plus ardente et plus fraternelle. Nous faisons la guerre parce que nous ne voulons pas que la France soit asservie. Parce que nous ne voulons pas que la France soit asservie.